This podcast is sponsored by the Music Player Network at musicplayer.com, the premier musician resource for keyboard players and beyond. Since the year 2000, the Music Player Network has been the go-to source for news and views on music technology, playing tips, and gigging help. The Keyboard Corner is one of the longest-running keyboard forums in internet history, with guitar, bass, drum, and numerous recording and music tech forums also on offer. Frequented by weekend warriors, manufacturers' representatives, and professionals alike, MPN provides an invaluable resource for any musician, and it's 100% free to sign up and use. Go to www.musicplayer.com to see for yourself.
Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the Keyboard Chronicles, a podcast for keyboard players of the gigging variety. I'm your host David Holloway and once again it's great to be here with you. As we talked about last episode, I'm really pleased to be joined on this episode by our previous guest, Paul Bindig, to co-host this and other episodes into the future. How are you going, Paul?
David, I'm going fantastically. Thank you very much.
Good. I thought we'd keep it low pressure for you as the first co-host gig and, you know, just get someone on the podcast that we don't really know that well just to take the pressure off, if that's all right.
You're right.
So you might gather from Paul's nervous laugh, we've got a bit of a big episode this one. So if you listen to the radio at any stage between the 80s and now, you definitely will have heard a swathe of In Excess songs. So, I mean, In Excess are legends in Australia, but worldwide they've sold over 50 million records. And Andrew Farris, their keyboard player and guitarist, co-wrote the vast majority of them with Michael Hutchence. So on top of that, he's also produced songs for a range of other people and he's still working very actively as a performer, as a country artist, with a self-titled album due out in May this year. He's actually got two songs already out and they, without a hint of bias, are bloody brilliant, in my opinion. Even if you don't like country, I think you will enjoy them. Would you agree, Paul?
Absolutely. You know, one thing about Andrew is he's an amazing songwriter, as we'll discuss in the podcast, and that absolutely shines through. And they're really great songs to listen to. And I agree with you, David. You don't have to be a inverted commas country music fan to really appreciate good songwriting, great hooks, and a great melody. And he's, you know, he's absolutely nailed it, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm hanging for that album, actually. It should be really good. So as an Australian-based podcast, we're a bit excited to have Andrew Farris join us today, but I think it's fair to say that, you know, he is a world-class musician and has things to say that will interest pretty much everyone. So shall we do it, Paul?
Let's go for it.
Let's do it. Andrew Farris, thanks so much for joining us. Much appreciated.
Hi, David. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how are you going?
So I thought we might kick off with a really obvious question, Andrew, but it's very pertinent given your extensive history in music, and that's what got you into music in the first place?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, I'll try to condense this story because it's quite long, but I was born on Cottesloe Beach in Western Australia. Just one of the outer suburbs on the beach there in Perth. And my dad had been in the Royal Navy at the end of World War II, and he came out to Australia and met my mother, who was Western Australian, and they had myself, my two brothers, and our younger sister wasn't born yet, but Dad wanted to go back and see my grandparents or his parents after 15 years. Over in London. So he put us on a ship, and then for 3 weeks we were on this small sort of ocean liner. It wasn't like the big party boats they have now, and they've been so sick in my life because of seasick, you know, for 3 weeks. And anyway, I remember holding Dad's hand going through the Port of Aden, and everybody sort of was dressed like Jesus, and then we went through the Suez Canal And I remember watching how close the ship was to the sides of the canal, which freaked me out. Also amazed me how the pilots could do that. Anyway, and got up to London and met my grandparents. My elder brother, Tim, would have been about seven, I guess. I would have been about five and a half or something. And my younger brother, John, was about three. And then we went to London, obviously. Some friends of ours had heard that my family was in London. So we got invited to go down to a variety show in 1964, and the Beatles walked out. And that's the first band I ever saw. Italy. Yeah. And so for my brothers and I, we were little kids, you know, sitting there with white shirts, just sort of black shorts and white socks and black shoes, watching this awesome performance by this group. You know, and we went back home again. And along the way, must have looked to each other, you know, went, what was that all about, you know? And then I think that was probably my first immersion into sort of the, you know, what was, you know, that was probably before they even exploded in the US. Mm. So it was pretty amazing thing to see when I, you know, later on, all these years later. And my dad, you know, because my brother Tim and I asked my dad, did that really happen? And he said, yeah, you sure it did. We were there, and you went and talked to them.
Oh, really?
Performance. So I'm like, yeah, and bizarre, right? Anyway, so the thing was that around about when I was, well, that was about five and a half, and then when I was about nine, my mother Jill suggested that I play piano, and my uncle had left a little upright Beale piano from the 50s, I guess it would have been early 50s. That piano. And I started to learn piano on it. And then, you know, I started doing the normal thing that kids do, learning scales and playing a little bit of, you know, row, row, row your boat or whatever it was I was playing back then, scales, you know. And then somewhere around that time, I don't know how old I would have been, maybe a year later, I was doing really well at it, but I just decided I got bored with it and I wanted to play football. I didn't really want to play keyboard, you know. And then about a year later, I hurt myself doing some kind of sport, probably footy. And then my mother said to me quietly, do you want to learn piano again? And I said, yeah, sure. All right. So I started learning again, and then I started picking up the piano. Well, then my parents, dad got a job promotion over in Sydney. So we all went over there, and my younger sister, Alison, was born at that point. And when we got to Sydney, because I didn't know anybody apart from my family when we got there. And so I started learning the piano again. But what I recognized was that I didn't really do that well. I couldn't keep my concentration on learning other people's music.
Yeah.
Right. I was okay at scales and stuff, but I just got bored with playing other people's music. So, and mum sort of said, what's the matter? And I said, look, I like playing the piano. I just, you know, and I was young, I didn't really understand what was going on with myself. So what I really want to do is play the pop songs I'm hearing on the radio. I don't really want to know about all this classical stuff. Yeah. It's interesting. And yeah, you know, these guys that lived 500 years ago were awesome, but I really don't want to do that. I want to play things that are happening now. And so, you know, she sort of listened to me, and instead of thinking, which is what I was a precocious brat. Instead, she went and you know, and found a Japanese teacher who sat with me and showed me how harmony works. You know, like if you have a C chord, that its relative minor is A minor. Yeah. And, you know, she showed me chord charts and things. We just sat together. And I think that was where my idea of construction of music came around, where it suddenly hit me that really, and no one had ever told me this, there are no rules in music. You can do whatever you want. You know, just because they have an examination system, you know, and a series of, which is for good reasons, with theory, and that if you're a creative person, you don't necessarily have to stick to someone else's music.
No.
You know, you can do whatever you want to do, right? And so as a little kid, then I started getting right into that and started messing around. I didn't even realize I was writing music. I just enjoyed the sort of, you know, the exercise of feeling liberated to do whatever I wanted to do. And then my uncle's old Beale piano had come with us, because my uncle lived in Sydney. And then probably to my parents and my uncle's horror, I then started taking the piano apart to see how it worked, you know? Right, yeah. And then, and that's funny, right? And then, and because I was really mesmerized by not only how music works, but by how the piano worked. And very recently someone said to me, do you have an engineering background? And I said, that's a really interesting question. And I said, what do you mean? I said, well, you seem to be really obsessed with construction. And I said, yeah, well, you're actually right. I always have been. It could be music or anything. I've got a farm I've owned for 28 years, and I like to know how everything works on that as well. It's part of my makeup as a person. I really am intrigued with how things work. You know, so I don't know. It's always been part of my personality. So cut a long story short, that's when my journey really began on the piano, and sort of led to my, then I was fascinated with, I used to sneak in and play my older brother Tim's classical guitar. He was taught, you know, to play classical guitar. He knows where all the notes are on the fretboard. I'm 60 years of age and I still don't know where all the notes are on the fretboard. I just make it up as I go along, you know, seriously. So I just, if I hear something that sounds right, then I'll go and play it,
you know. So, I mean, and that, I mean, I always love a story where the Beatles have inspired, because you don't actually have that many people that had the privilege of doing what you've done there. But so it sounds like that in the initial phase set off a bit of a music playing dynamic at home with your family. So you all tended to sound like fall in your roles as far as piano, guitar and that fairly early on.
Yeah, well, that's right. It's the Farris brothers, my brothers and I, that's exactly right. And then, that's right. And Tim had a mate, Kirk, who he went to school with. And what's even more bizarre is Gary, the bass player, also went to school with them, but he sort of wasn't their mate for whatever reason. I actually met Gary, through a newspaper ad in the old days in Sydney. It might have been a trading magazine for gear. And not only did he have his own bass amp, because he was advertising himself as a bass player, but we were kids and he had his own car, and I was like, wow, you've got your car, man, that's fantastic, you know? And that's how I met Gary. And then I eventually pulled in my friend Michael, who wasn't a singer. He was just, he wrote poetry and he was a mate of ours. And I sort of invited him into what I was doing, you know? So, yeah.
So with Michael, Andrew, obviously your partnership with him is probably one of the most successful in Australian music history in terms of writing songs together. And you mentioned yourself, he wasn't necessarily a musician, but a guy who was a poet and wrote these amazing words. When you wrote together at the outset, but also as the band became more and more successful, did you guys have strongly conflicting ideas on how the songs would end up sounding and being, or was that quite an easy process for you guys?
We don't have one. Michael and I have never had one of these sort of acrimonious experiences that you can hear about with songwriting partnerships that have been really, you know, immensely successful. We never really had that. We were very different personalities for a start. And we used to joke about that later on when we got really successful. I remember, in fact, right towards the end of Michael's life, he sat with me and he had a lot of issues running in the back end of his life at that point. And I had empathy for that. And we were sitting there together and we looked at how far we'd come and what we'd achieved. And he said, you know, you're funny, you know. I walk out there and everyone's throwing roses at me but you don't want the same things that I want. And I said, I know, mate, that's probably why we get on so well, is because we're very different personality types. Yeah. You know, it doesn't bother me. If you want to, I didn't actually say this, but you know, in a sense, if you want to be Julius Caesar, that's up to you, mate. You know, it doesn't really bother me, and the thing that I most loved about my artistic and creative, thing that I did with Michael is we're both pretty open-minded. The other big difference was that he never really came at it from a musician point of view his voice was his instrument. And he didn't even think of himself as a singer. When I first met him, he wasn't really interested in that. He just liked to write prose and, you know, short haiku and was interested in poets like Carl Gibran or you know, and Hermann Hesse and people like that, when most of the teenagers I knew were about getting laid and playing footy and, you know what I mean, and drinking too much beer and, you know, and trying to get to learn to drive cars. He was talking about that kind of stuff. And I recognized that that was a little different when I was younger and that he was a little different like that. You know, he probably was a very much a loner like that. And I recognized that too, because you see, I'd come from Perth where I didn't know anybody, you know, from Perth where I knew everybody, to Sydney where I didn't know anybody either. So, and you know, so when we first met each other, we're both in a funny kind of way, loners, you know? And that's probably where, you know, our friendship struck up. And the funny thing was, when I first met him, we didn't talk about music at all. Mm-hmm. Nothing. We just talked about, I don't know what we talked about, motorbikes and, you know, whatever we talked about. I used to like making rockets as well, see how high they could fly, you know, and stuff like that. Yeah, like just teenage, young, adolescent stuff, I guess. But then, you know, a lot of things happened, but where my journey sort of really started with it all was musically and with instruments and all that kind of thing, as well as I used to sing a bit, but I was really, you know, and I suppose a musician in that sense, you know, whereas Michael really wasn't a musician, and that was another reason why we got on really well.
Yeah.
Sure, he was a musician as he got more and more, you know, proficient at singing. Yeah, sure, he was a musician. He's one of the best musicians in the world as far as a singer goes. Mm. But when he started, so one of the other things that was important about our songwriting thing that people don't pick up on and don't talk about very much is that he never really, it wasn't a competitive thing with, yeah, that was pretty good, dude. Now watch this. And then you go and play something. And there was never any of that competitive sort of chest beating thing musically between us. You know, it was like, and he would talk instead of saying, can we go from the one to the four to the five to the, you know, two and a six or whatever. You know, he wasn't talking like that. It was always like, this needs to be a little darker or lighter, or we need to, you know, speed this up. And I loved that, because as a musician, it gave me a lot of freedom, you know, to be able to say, well, I interpret that to mean this. And so I would create the piece of music or the groove or the beat or whatever along the lines what he was trying to say, you know, and vice versa. You know, he didn't really understand when I said to him, look, I think, you know, it should go to a B minor here. Yeah. And he sort of stare at me because he didn't really know what that was, you know. And if you see what I'm saying, that communication that we had was far more important than either of us realized as it went along, because we didn't compete, you know, there's no competition. You know? So, yeah, you know, because otherwise he could have very easily taken the view, well, I'm the front man, you know, I'm the one that's getting really famous here and all these dudes, and so I'll just write all the music myself. And but in some ways he didn't really know how to.
Yeah, yeah. So you guys really complimented each other.
You just hit the nail on the head. That's right. And we both knew it, you know.
Yeah, which is fantastic. So digging into the songwriting process a bit more, just for yourself personally, are you the sort of guy where, you know, maybe you're watching the cricket or the football on TV and suddenly inspiration hits you and, oh, goodness me, I've got to go grab my pen and paper and write this out because this is something? Or are you more the type to be a bit more methodical and, okay, between 9 and 11 I'm going to sit down and write some tunes today and give myself some quiet time to do that? How does the process work for you?
Yeah, generally I do like to be in my own, what I call dream space. I like my dream space when I'm trying to create. You know, I need to just sit and think carefully about what I'm trying to say lyrically, or what the mood of the music is, and does the lyrics suit. And sometimes more and more and more in the last sort of, I suppose, 30 years, I'm lyrically, you know, I'll be out somewhere in the world and I'll just see a situation or read something or feel something, and then I jot a few little lyrics down, and that's pretty much how Michael worked a bit too. And then, but I'll come back to them. I don't finish it right there and there, and you know, all the time. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I get this great big sort of stream of consciousness, mm-hmm. and I'll just blurt out this whole thing, and later on I go, where on earth did that come from, you know? And other times, I'll sit and really labor and sweat over something, trying to make it work. But I've learned over the years more and more not to worry about that so much. And if it's not ready to sort of, jump out of the box, it's just not ready. There's a certain sort of almost like a kind of a Buddhist thing to that. You just don't keep pushing it. Mm-hmm. And when it's ready to turn up, it's going to turn up,
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. And, I mean, related to that with your keyboard playing, both historically, what influenced your musical ideas and learnings from a piano or keyboard playing perspective as you started out and further developed your skills?
Yeah, okay. Well, in the churches were around, and I'm talking in the 60s, late 60s, during the 70s when I was a teenager, most of the 70s I was a teenager. And during that time, the local churches would have organs, and some of them were pretty cool, little Hammonds and stuff, with the drawbars and all that. And when the church would go out and everyone would leave the church, I'd be like, I couldn't wait till everyone left the church so I could run back in and play the Hammond organ, right, in the church. And I used to love experimenting with it. I didn't take it apart. I was tempted to, but I they wouldn't have liked that. But anyway, but I loved the sound of Leslie cabinets they had and stuff. And, I'd been listening to all kinds of rock music back then that I thought was really cool, including, bands like Deep Purple with John Lord and these heavy sort of, Leslie parts and Steve Winwood or whatever it was back then. And, I'd love to be, sit there going, oh boy, this sounds fantastic. And it did actually in the room. That was awesome, sounding keyboards. But also with the piano, I was still banging away on my uncle's poor old Beale piano that had come with us for the ride during the 70s. And by that time, I'd began to construct songs on that old piano. And so between that, and then of course, somewhere in the 70s appeared some really, really, ancient synthesizers. Mm. I'm trying to think of the manufacturers, but Roland might have been one of them. And there was another one, and I thought these things were incredible. And my mates and I, who were a bit nerdy, tried to work out how they were constructed, like I said before, from an engineering background, and tried to actually make these things ourselves with soldering irons and, fiddling around being nerdy, trying to recreate these things. And they slowly but surely got more sophisticated, the synthesizers, and got more powerful, slowly but surely, and more stable, because a lot of these things, it's very hard for people, it's very hard for some readers or the people listening to this to understand how unstable some of these old synthesizers were, you can get your laptop now and stick some literally mind-boggling array of sounds that are available to if you're working sort of, either in pop or EDM, whatever it is, you're doing hip hop and you grab all these sounds that, people would have, chopped off a part of their body physically to create, because there was just no way to do it, without some sort of pain, and you can get all these incredible sounds. Well, back then it wasn't really like that. And I was a huge fan of, say, people like Rick Wakeman or, all these early sort of pioneers, Kraftwerk, guys like that, who made all these things, Tangerine Dream, all sound incredible. And, one of my favorite soundtracks of all time is the Blade Runner soundtrack with Harrison Ford in that film. Is it a Yamaha? Is it MS-80 or whatever it is? I think it is. But that's, I love all that stuff where people were really pioneering with sounds and those sorts of things. But the point is that all these things to me, all of the sounds that are nerdy sort of things that I was messing around with and trying to experiment with myself, as a songwriter, as it all went along, all these things I were interested in, I began to realize that as a songwriter, there's two different things. One thing is writing a song or writing a piece of music. And then the other part of it is, what instrumentation do you use to best you know, emphasize or to, you know, to display or perform the song that you're creating, because the two of those are where the really deadly combination comes in, where if you have the right sounds and the right groove and the right feels for everything you're doing, and you've written the right song, you've got a monster right there, you know. And that's where I realized it was the assembling of all these things that went along. And, you know, for me as a musician, the guitars came along, acoustic guitar. I always played acoustic guitar. I had, a Hummingbird Ibanez copy I bought somehow in the old days. I loved playing that. But I never really got into electric guitar till a bit later on. And then I started to realize where the electric guitar really had a burn for me as an instrument was where I began to discover the funk stuff you can play on guitar is very different than the kind of stylization of playing, you know, on a keyboard. Synthesizer maybe a bit more, and samples and stuff with keys is great for funk and kind of EDM stuff, but for piano is so much more, I don't know what it is, bluesy, jazzy. Funk is great too, but there's, you know, it's like it just has this beautiful, piano has this beautiful organic thing with it where it just, it's going to do whatever it's going to do. I remember Dad had, you know, Ray Charles vinyl records when we were kids. We used to listen to a lot of his music, and I think because Dad had been in the Royal Navy, he had a lot of exposure to a lot of American music and things that they used to pick up when they were rolling around. And so we used to listen to a lot of Latin music as well, also those grooves and samba and all those feels. I was always intrigued as well, as were my brothers as well, but you know, and John, my younger brother, the drummer, you know, he was always intrigued with all these grooves and things on these records. And so if you see where I'm heading, it was really all of this I didn't really realize when I was younger was heading towards what made up, eventually became the sound of In Excess, is all these things contributed towards it. You know, and I think, you know, as the legacy of In Excess has gone on and on and on, you know, in some ways we're incredibly fortunate because we have a legacy. But in some ways I'm perhaps more proud than anything of what we achieved together as a group of people. You know, Michael's fame and his performance level and as a vocalist was unbelievable. I think he was one of the greatest in the world at that. But I want to also say, as a musician and with my brothers and for Kirk and Gary, that I fully believe I played with some of the best musicians in the world. And I really, you know, I know how hard we worked at it. We worked in 52 countries and we promoted being Australians the whole way. We were never embarrassed about being Australians overseas. There was a thing, I think, in the 60s and early 70s in Australia, if you went overseas, you sort of wanted to say you were British or Scottish or whatever because you didn't want to make... And when we first went to the United States, you know, in the very early 80s, there wasn't... It's really hard to imagine what it was like now because of the internet, and we have actors and actresses, you know, all picking up Academy Awards, and that's fantastic. Australians, you know, and New Zealanders. And but it's really hard to explain what it was like back then. You'd go to a radio station and they'd say, "Are you guys Austrian?"
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think you raise a really critical point there, Andrew, about the link between the construction side of things and the musicians playing together. I mean, you guys, and it's easy with hindsight to claim this, but I'd argue even at the time of the swing and Listen Like Thieves, you guys sounded like something totally different and world-class and not necessarily Australian. And it's based on that combination of those factors.
Yeah, well, that's right. And we'd already taken on, we made a decision as a group and we were lucky. Let me throw that in what you just said, because I appreciate what you just said. But we were also lucky, you know, like we were lucky just because people are talented, and there's so many talented people both in Australia and overseas who never get recognized, you know, and they're so much more talented than me or the people I've ever worked with as musicians or singers or songwriters or whatever. and they never get recognized. You know, there's an element of luck that's got to come into it, and timing of what you're doing in the genre that you're in. You know, a lot of that is luck. I don't care what anyone says, and I take the view that John Lennon said, which he said, "You're lucky if anybody likes you," yeah. And I agree with that.
That's right.
I totally agree with that.
It's a really good point. Lucky. Yeah, no, it's a great point. Yeah. And I mean, we don't want to talk too much about gear specifics because that can get a bit boring. But I mean, do you recall, you know, over the years, what were your go-to rigs? What are things you still look back fondly on now, as far as keyboards that, or and ones probably that you don't miss and are glad to have booted out the door?
Keyboards.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I had a I had a little tape. It was the only thing I could afford. I had like a little I forgot what the brand was now. I had like a little tape echo thing that I thought was the most sophisticated thing in the world in the late 70s that I owned. And one of the things I loved about it was half broken, so that like the capstan with the tape running around would wobble, and that would create chorus.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? Like it'd have a effect, you know, and all those sorts of things. And I know, you know, hopefully if people, you know, can understand this, that, you know, from that era, is that you just didn't, like, you buy a modern keyboard and the sounds that are on it are simply, you know, mind-boggling with how much choice you've got with the kind of sounds and things you have on them to choose from, you know. In fact, there's almost too many.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's the limitations of what you don't have to work with that makes you work harder. You know, like sometimes it was those things that challenged you that you didn't have or couldn't own, or you didn't have enough money, and so you made the thing work anyway. I remember when Marlena, my wife, and I, you know, we went on a holiday, and yeah, and they had a, like a bamboo tubes,
oh, yeah,
tied together with tree lights. Yep. And they were hitting, like they had one end closed off, and they tuned them all to make like a xylophone thing, but a vertical one. And they were hitting it with, like, you know, rubber flip-flops or thongs, as Australians call them, but thongs overseas, especially in the US, yeah, lingerie. But anyway, so they'd be hitting, you know, they'd be hitting the tops of these things going, and I was sitting there admiring that they'd made instruments out of nothing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
it didn't have a synthesizer with a piece of bamboo thing that sounded like that you could hit with your flip flop. They just made whatever they could out of what they had, and it sounded great, you know. And that's more my point, is I think, you know, especially when it comes to live performance on stuff, you know, it's working within that area where you're really fortunate to have what you have. And you know, and sometimes I still do like limiting myself to things. And but the question you asked me is, what instruments have I ditched? I probably would say I had always wanted, you know, a really good Stratocaster, and I made one out of parts when I first could afford to buy anything like that in the late 70s, and it wasn't a very good guitar. So somewhere around, but I carried it for a long time. I played it. Don't know what I did with it in the end. But in 1985, I came across, I was in Chicago, and actually we were writing music there, and for one of the albums. And I sat down and I was kind of working on this piece, and I thought, I really need a better guitar now. So I went down to a guitar shop in Chicago, and I bought a 1956 Strat for $800. Back then, and then I've had the guitar ever since, you know. So but yeah, no, you know, I really instruments are very interesting things. And that old piano I was talking about that I started to play when I was 9, my uncle called me recently and said, would I like to have it?
Oh, wow.
And keep it. Yeah, and I was really blown away with that. I thought he might have thrown it out or whatever, but he didn't, and I got it restored back to its sort of original 1950s condition. And they did, you know, to having exactly the right look, and they left certain things inside it and on it to that can verify its pedigree of what, you know, serial numbers and special stickers the factory would have put on it. But and it sounds beautiful. He just came and tuned it up for me recently, the piano restorer. And we were both admiring it. And he was saying, you know, this is a great little piano. I said, yeah, no kidding. you know, and that was that was what, 50 years ago, I guess, or something. But I have that again, and I love it. Absolutely love it. Instruments I've thrown out. I've always loved my instruments. Someone made the comment when they got one of my instruments that I was selling. I said, "This thing looks like it's hardly been used." Yeah. And I said, "Yeah, well, because I like to look after things, you know. I value the things I own. I'm lucky to have them."
And my understanding is, Andrew, is over the years you have always liked checking out what's new that helps you creatively. I mean, I don't know whether it's an apocryphal story, but, you know, in the recording studio it wasn't unusual for you to turn up with a new piece of gear and say, "Look, why don't we see what this can do for us?"
Yeah, sure. That's right. And as a band, that's right. Kirk Pengilly, I always loved the way Kirk would always encourage me to experiment with things because he knew I was a bit nerdy. And actually, we were both nerdists in that way, where, if I can use that expression, where we were both, Kirk and I, were multi-instrumentalists within NXS, and the two of us, you know, shared that common interest in experimenting. I mean, Kirk himself is an incredible musician. Well, they all the guys in NXS are and were, but Kirk, he played three, maybe four different types of saxophones. Great lead guitarist, great acoustic guitarist, very underrated lead guitarist in my opinion. But anyway, a great singer, you know, in his own right. I'm a multi-instrumentalist too. That's probably why they stuck us on the same side of the stage. You know, we'll put the nerds over there. We definitely had that interest together. But, and so he would encourage me, early on, and to use when sampling technology came out and all of that sort of thing. I would make up sounds. I wouldn't just use the library. Sometimes I used the library that the sample would come from, like an emulator 2 or whatever. I thought that was the most incredibly sophisticated piece of gear I'd ever seen when I first used that. And, I can remember one of my mates came around, a friend who's not a musician, one day, and he was absolutely gobsmacked when I picked up a microphone and I said some swear word into it. And I said, "Here, play this button on the keyboard." And it kept going F at him, F, F, F back at him, you know. He's going, "What is that?" And I said, "Well, that's a sampler. That's, mate, that's what that is, you know." And so, you know, but I used to love, which sounds like a strange thing to say, I used to love taking sounds that were very analog, not digitized sample sounds. I used to experiment with making up sounds with older analog instruments and then sampling them so that I could then have control over them. Whereas in years before, you didn't have a lot of control sometimes over what those sounds were. You see what I mean? Like, in other words, I used to sample sounds or someone, you know, people singing or whatever it was, so that I could recreate it without, you know, that constant variable that happens live, which, to be honest with you now, in 2020, I've come a full circle. I actually love the variable randomness of playing live. Whereas in the old days, a lot of technology was there so that, you know, it's like a lot of modern musicians and composers and, artists, DJs love the fact that there is no random, inconsistency or whatever. They know that when they push this button or they do this thing or whatever they do, that it's going to be exactly the same way that they thought it was going to be, you know. But as I've gone along now I'm in 2020, I've come a bit of a full circle. I like working with old school instruments, classical instruments or country, especially country music instruments that do drift a little bit in pitch and they don't do all the things that a lot of the electronic media does. They are a little bit wild and random. Yeah. I actually love that again now. I love it. Yeah.
Well, I'd love to pick up on that, Andrew, in terms of what's going on these days and your experiences from the past and how they inform what you're doing now. And you've got a new self-titled solo album coming out in May this year, I believe, and that's a country music album. And I'm really interested in what's inspired you to move into that genre.
Yeah, well, sure, that's a good question. And I think as far as that goes, my journey to that, well, first of all, I've always loved country music, and I can even remember back on Dad's old Ray Charles records, being intrigued with why, you know, the genius, you know, from a jazz sort of, like, I would call him rock in some ways as well, early rock, would go then to play country music, you know, Ray Charles, right? And then I apply that because there's something in it, especially as a songwriter, you know, the country music genre have a kind of a mantra that they talk about, which is it all begins with the song, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas sometimes, you know, a lot more pop-orientated or kind of electronic type stuff doesn't really begin with a song at all, begins with other stuff. But in the country genre, it's really all about the song. And I, as a songwriter, you know, as a tunesmith, I completely understand that idea. Tanya Kernaghan asked me almost 20 years ago now, maybe it is even 20 years ago, to produce an album for her, album she was recording called Big Sky Country. And I co-wrote with Tan and her sister Fiona. And we had encouragement from Lee Kernaghan as well. In fact, from the Kernaghan parents even, you know, so they're delighted I was working with them. But I felt, you know, really uncomfortable at first because it was a new genre to me. I didn't really know anyone in that community of people. But as it went along, because I was working within that genre, I met a whole lot of musicians and people I would never have met before, songwriters and other people. And that was my first kind of, I suppose, wake up call, if you like, or crossing of the streams, where I suddenly realized I'm not in the kind of rock pop area I've been in. I'm doing something else with all these people. That's really interesting. You know, it's not a safety zone for me. You know, I can't swan around in it, you know, beating my chest. I've got to earn my stripes if I want to be with all these people. I have to, you know, listen a lot and learn and get educated. And one of the people who's now become one of my best mates, and we just played together, you know, and we have played together quite a bit in the last year. His name's Laurie Minson. Laurie's he's sort of country music royalty out of Tamworth there. His father, John Minson, was a local legend in Tamworth. He's the one that designed the golden guitar that they'll give each other. Yeah, Laurie's dad. But I've been working with Laurie a fair bit, and I'd say he's probably one of Australia's most proficient musicians ever, especially in the country music genre. He plays pedal steel. He plays a 1930s slide guitar that'll blow your mind. He plays both harmonica, like straight harmonica, and can play blues harp like the devil. You know, he plays electric guitars, acoustic guitars. He's just unbelievable. You know, really proficient at all of his instruments. Mm. And that's the other thing about those country music people is that they, when all the rest of the world turned technical, they kept playing. You know,
kept
playing their instruments. You know,
I'm also,
instead of pushing buttons.
I'm also wondering. You mentioned before, Andrew, about the fact that we've got so many options to choose from as far as sounds now that it's good to be somewhat limited. And even though, I mean this in a positive way, not a stereotypical way, country music does tend to have a set instrumentation as a general rule. Do you find that that's freed you up a little bit to focus on the song rather than, you know, well, what sounds am I choosing?
Well, exactly, and that you hit the nail on the head with that too. And that part of my own sort of thinking was when I went to record my own country music album was exactly that. It was to try and use instruments that, you know, have been around and will be around, I think, forever in that music genre, like, you know, mandolins, pedal steels, fiddles, which of course, you know, come from the classical world of violins. You know, upright basses, which originally were bass instruments in an orchestra. Banjos, you know, which were instruments that came from out of the combination of cultures in the US and European culture mixed together. You know, all these sorts of instruments, to me as a songwriter, you know, suddenly have become really fascinating because, you know, they are intertwined with not only a music genre, but with the songwriters that work within that genre too. And to me, it's been a real challenge and exciting for me, you know, to walk into this genre and so far be accepted by both here in Australia and in the United States, in particular with the people I've been working with. And I feel really, really, really honoured and blessed to be doing that, because I'm not taking it lightly. It's not some pop adventure for me. I really love the challenge of it. And I have a lot of friends now that I've known for a long time within that community of people, and they've become my friends, my mates, and my wife and I socialize with them as well. And I love what they do. I like hanging with them, even when we're not. You know, we've got some friends in Nashville there they're professional, in their own right, solo artists. And we just like to get together and sit around the piano and play music together, you know, after dinner. It's got nothing to do with writing songs or whatever. We just like hanging, you know. And to me, that's how I started off when I was a teenager. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not, you know, like a lot of people think that when you become, you know, really successful, that you, the only time you're ever playing music is where it's professional.
Yeah. But yeah, music still has that power to bring people together, doesn't it? I mean, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. You know, I go, here I am doing what I'm doing now, and I'm sort of behaving a little bit again, which is probably not such a good thing, like I'm a teenager or in my early 20s, just having fun playing music with people again. You know, I don't really, you know, that's the area that I'm finding most exciting about it, actually.
Yeah, hey, Andrew, I'm really interested in which instruments you've played on the new tracks. And obviously I mentioned the album's not coming out till May, but you've released a couple of singles, which you've listened to, Good Mama Bad and Come Midnight. And then there's various instrumentation in there. So, yeah, curious, we see you playing guitar in the video clips. So what other instruments have you played on the album and that we'll be able to hear you getting involved with?
I've used LP shakers. Yeah. And LP tambourines. No, but seriously, no, pianos. So I have an upright piano, like a Toles with a little Beal. Yep. I have also an older Steinway piano that I shipped into my studio at the farm where I live in the northwest of New South Wales. I shipped that there many years ago, and it's now settled down, and it's a beautiful sounding instrument. It's mellowed a bit. But I also, I really love my acoustic guitars. On the opening track on my album, I played a classical guitar that it's a flamenco Spanish guitar that I bought off an old guitar maker in Chile. And I bought that off him and I played that. And then Tammy Rogers King, who normally plays with the Steel Drivers and with Chris Stapleton's band, they were there playing together for a while. But she and I do a kind of duet musically on the opening track a bit there. But there's other instruments in there that she played mandolin, by the way, and well, she plays fiddle. But the other instruments that I played, the electric guitar, sure, Strat. My Strat, my 56 Strat, and I've got a couple of Delis. I have a 1947 Southern Jumbo Gibson that I love to pieces. I never take it on the road because I'm too paranoid to take it on the road. It just sounds awesome. And then I have other, instruments, I think, that I've messed around with. I'll still use a keyboard, like a synth a little bit. Here and there, mainly to put a sort of effects and ambient stuff in the background. But I don't have a screaming synthesizer lead solo or something. You know, I don't have all that going on. And most of the keyboards are very organic, you know. And when I was working with the musicians in Nashville that tracked quite a bit of my record along the way with me, I asked them, you know, to mainly stick to the pianos and organ sounds and those sorts of things. There's some string sounds, classical string sounds, which I've always loved anyway. and you know, that sort of thing. But most of the instrumentation, again, is sort of basically just a bass guitar, you know, live drums, you know, electric guitars. Troy Lancaster played a lot of electric guitar on my recordings. He's an amazing player. He uses a Strat like I do as well. He's an awesome player. They all were. All the guys that played with me. Larry Beard, who owns the studio that I recorded a lot in, his family, it's basically a family studio. Mm-hmm. His son Eli played bass and on a lot of the recordings. And I had a series of amazing players coming in and out. Scotty Sanders on pedal steel. Laurie Minson played a bit as right. well on my recordings, as did, well, a few people actually. And I'm playing live with a lot of those guys now too, Mitch Farmer and Dario Bortolan as well, and Ashley Leith on vocals with me, Lauren Azar on keys and vocals, and and also John Michael Kirk, who I call Trev, has played a bit of bass as well. But the recordings that I cut in Nashville, it's going to sound like a funny thing to say, but because I've worked as a music producer, mm-hmm. as well as a songwriter and as a musician, with these people who are, you know, A-grade session players that I was working with in Nashville, I suddenly sort of realized once I began my journey with all those guys and girls, is that the best thing I could do was keep my mouth shut.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, and let them be the people they are with their expertise. And if they suggest something that might be better than what I'm playing or what I'm doing, I'll go, yeah, great. You know, like the best, that's an old Beatles expression, the best idea wins. It's not about, you know, was it my ego, was it yours, or, you know, it's not about all that. It's about whatever makes the song or the recording sound as good as possible.
You raise a good point there, Andrew, as far as, I mean, in that process or external to that, are there players that have caught your attention that you've thought, gee, I like what they're doing at the moment?
Sure. You know, there's a lot of players out there that are incredible. I mean, it's also just a yes. The simple answer is yes. And, yeah, and, you know, sure. But there's a lot of younger players coming up now too, and I find that really exciting, both in Australia and overseas, where they're excited to play old school, old-fashioned instruments again, you know, and want to champion that idea. And I think that's exciting because I think, you know, even though there is, you know, some amazing technology available to people, younger people, and they can make Grammy award-winning, you know, recordings in their bedroom at a young age, I think that is incredible. And I think that's, I really honestly think that's amazing and a great thing. I also think that the art of performing live with old school instruments is very important too. And the two of them, they're equally important, but there's something about the old school instruments that has a something about it. Maybe it's because it is flawed.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because it is slightly out of tune. Maybe it's because it's slightly out of tempo. Maybe it's because, you know, it has these human errors in it that I find sometimes quite attractive. I'm not, you know, I'm not saying that a lot of the new technology is not, you know, amazing. It is amazing. You can make a very average player sound like an absolute yes. genius would have sounded not that long ago, because you can auto-tune and you can do all this stuff to it, tighten it all up and frig around with it and make it sound just insanely clever. But then, you know, it's a bit like the Olympics, isn't it? You know, with the runners, with drugs.
That's right. And I know we've got to let you go in a minute, Andrew, but just probably one last question on that same vein is how are you seeing the music industry currently, and what advice would you have for young players, and probably because of this podcast, keyboard players, to try and get a foothold and maybe make a career of it?
Well, exactly. I mean, one of the great platforms that exists these days is some of the new digital platforms, where they don't want to take all your, you know, all your rights, that you get to own your copyrights and you get to own your life, you know, and get your music out there and find these, you know, whether it's SoundCloud or, you know, iTunes or whatever the next thing will be. Because as I'm saying this, someone read this in 20 years' time and go, how old-fashioned is that? So it doesn't matter what tech, right? It doesn't matter what technology I talk about now. It's all going to be outdated in 10 or 20 years. So what I'll say is a more generic thing, which is just use the opportunities that exist in the platform in your era. Take those opportunities and run with them. And if they're available and they're offering opportunities for you to advertise your music or to get it out on platforms where people can buy it or see you or understand you, then do it. And the other thing is if you feel comfortable to get out live and play to people, doesn't matter whether it's 10 people or 10,000 people, do it. Get out there and play in front of people. Don't be afraid to share that. I think we've gotten used to the idea that only live performance, you know, is run by television and you have to be a reality contest winner or something. That's not true. You can play anywhere to anyone, anytime. And you're allowed to make mistakes and you're allowed to have fun.
Exactly. And great advice and timeless advice, that stuff. So, Andrew, it's been an absolute privilege talking to you. I really appreciate it. And, very excited about the new album in May and look forward to listening to it.
Oh, great.
And there we have it. So, Paul, first podcast, is it all downhill from here for you?
I'm afraid it absolutely is. You know, I grew up listening to NXS. They were the one band I loved in high school. And look, I can probably die happy now, David. I really enjoyed talking to Andrew. He was fantastic.
It is a bit like that. And look, I still play Don't Change in a covers band pretty much every gig. And the next time I play, it's going to be going, I am not worthy, but it was great talking to him, and I think he had some pretty interesting insights there on both what he's done previously and what he's doing now. So, yes, very excited. Where to from here, I don't know, but we will be back in a fortnight or so. But just a reminder in the meantime that you can keep in touch via a few means. So our website is www.keyboardchronicles.com. We're on Facebook at Keyboard Chronicles or on Twitter at The Keyboard CHR1. But if you like good old-fashioned email, then do drop us a line at editor@keyboardchronicles.com. It's always great to get feedback. And if you do use a podcatcher like Apple Music or what used to be called iTunes or one of the others, reviews of the podcast does help us immensely. So if you were able to take a few seconds to do that, it'd be greatly appreciated. And obviously a huge thank you to you, Paul, for joining me as a co-host this episode. Obviously, we'll be catching up with each other on a regular basis.
Yeah, and thanks for inviting me, David. I had a great time.
And most importantly, thanks to you for listening and hope to see you back here next episode.